Okay, well, thanks for giving me the opportunity to give the second talk. So I'm actually formerly part of the cancer resistance group, which we'll be meeting in about a week. But I also work on microbial resistance to antibiotics and to phage. And I'm kind of killing two birds with one stone here, since the opportunity to give this talk means I've had to revamp my microbial resistance talk. So I'm happy to give it to you and get your feedback on what I have to say. What I'd like to do is, before launching into this, and I've thrown together like 100 slides, so stop me after an hour or whenever, I'll just stop. But actually the punchline of all this is in the last 5 slides, so I'll probably have to skip big swaths in order to make it there on time, but we'll see what happens. I want to start out by making a comment on our discussion yesterday about the Pardi-Sabidi paper, the one on sequencing the spread of Ebola. And that is questions that came up of why they did the study and what the relevance of all this is, which is actually not that clear from reading that manuscript, aside from trying to trace back where the virus came from. But we could actually go a bit further with that kind of data, which they haven't done quite yet, but with more data in the future, maybe we can get there, and that is understanding the evolution of transmission, virulence, and these kinds of emerging pathogens. And some of the work that's interested me that I've been doing more in theoretical vein over the past 10 or 15 years is trying to understand coevolution of virulence and transmission in spreading pathogens. And what we expect during the initial phases of a species jump, for example, from bats to humans in the case of Ebola, is not necessarily what we expect at the points of optimization, what's predicted by optimization theory. And that is, we start out by being very, very far from the optimum. So here's a representation of what a trajectory of different genotypes would look like, optimized, let's say, on bats, okay? And we'd expect selection somehow to push us up towards some kind of optimum, which will be a trade-off between transmission and virulence. So this is kind of classical theory, represented in a slightly different way. Now, what might be happening in the case of Ebola and other emerging pathogens, where there's been a species jump, is that we're starting off somewhere else in this parameter space, this blue area being feasible fitness. So fitness is greater than 1 everywhere here, so any of these genotypes can possibly grow. Okay, so we might have some kind of trajectory that's predicted by other models, which may or may not reach the same point, depending upon the change in the habitat from bats to humans, but we could have an expectation that will tend to go in the same kind of direction. So we can apply some general theory, and this has actually been re-derived many times by different authors, where we can find the probability of emergence in a sufficiently large host population, represented by N, which is simply given by recovery rate plus virulence divided by the effective transmission. So it's 1 minus that. So that gives us the basic reproductive number, which is perhaps a bit deceptive because this requires sufficiently large N to become exact. When N is small, things are stochastic, and we can get different kinds of effects. But what we do know is that we'll get some kind of positive selection based upon this same kind of model. So here, I is the invading mutant, R would be the resident, as long as this ratio exceeds this one. And that's simply the definition of the basic reproductive number increasing. Otherwise put, holding recovery constant, change in transmission just has to exceed change in virulence, approximately. And so I've studied this using 2 different kinds of models. This goes back 10 or 15 years, it's still unpublished, where what I did is start off with a single clone at an arbitrary level of alpha virulence and beta transmission, and then let this clone evolve, mutate. So it's mutating in 2 different directions, beta and alpha. I assume no trade-offs. No trade-offs are assumed here. What this refers to here, 10U, 20U, 50U, are the number of time units. So 10U is 10 time units after the initial ancestor invades, 20 is 20 and 50 and so forth. What we observe is dispersion of the points around this initial founder in both directions. But what's really interesting here, what you should see from these lines, is that there's a positive correlation, at least initially, that emerges between virulence and transmission. Okay, so if we were to sequence and look at life history traits of the different individual pathogens in this population and plot them in this way, we would expect a positive correlation between virulence and transmission. Now, we formalized this together with a colleague, Jean-Baptiste André, in a stochastic population setting. We looked again at transmissibility and virulence. Now, unfortunately, the axes have changed. And we looked at different population sizes. So here, 200 hosts, here, 1,000 hosts. What this shows in terms of shading is a feasible area for emergence. The pathogen will make the species jump in this area if transmission is sufficiently large and virulence sufficiently low, which is what we would expect. These points refer to successful emergences in the stochastic population model, which by and large fit the analytical prediction. The analytical prediction, okay? And what you'll see from here, if we were to generate a series of genotypes from these species jumps that will get, for sufficiently small populations, what appears to be a positive correlation. So we're basically taking these points, drawing a general line through it between transmission and virulence. As the number of hosts increase, this positive correlation tends to disappear. So this more or less confirms what we just shown. And in the same study, what we were able to do is look at different initial host population sizes, average mean virulence in the emerging pathogen, and lo and behold, what we show is, depending upon the maximum constraint that we put on virulence, regardless of that constraint, we always have the same kind of shape of curve. Larger host populations attain larger initial mean virulences. Okay, so maybe there's something here that we can discuss after, which could be applied to this understanding of what we could expect in the initial phases of emergence in Ebola. Okay, now this is not good. Well, let's keep going. Okay, so this is the talk. I'll only be presenting this result in the last four or five slides of the talk. What I'd like to do is, by way of introduction, talk to you about the problem of antibiotic resistance, a problem that many of you are already familiar with, but given that we have a diverse audience here, I think it's important to bring everybody on the same page, and then how we can use evolutionary theory to understand more about the underpinnings and workings of antibiotic resistance and alternative therapies to try to control pathogens. So this is something I picked off the internet. Internet is now the routine place to find slides and to put some colors into one's talks. And I came across this slide, which is actually backed up by some data from WHO and OECD, of the impact of different forms of mortality over the 20th century globally, okay, this in the world. So this adds up to about 6 billion. And what we find is, what we see is that infectious disease explains roughly one-third of the mortality in the 20th century globally. Can we get that tech guy back? Maybe it's this. Or maybe it's the computer. Okay, this appears to be plugged in. It's not this. Okay, let's just try going. Okay. So, evidently, over a span of 100 years, evidently varying considerably from country to country in the world. But nevertheless, what this suggests is that when we look at infectious disease, look at mortality factors within any given country, we'll find a characteristic set, many of these repeatable from country to country, of pathogens that we know are the real killers that are found either through infectious disease or found in hospitals through nosocomial infections. These are extremely diverse, and numerous systems are involved. And this is really just a short list, which is, again, this is part of a CDC pamphlet. The pathogen that I work on, Pseudomonas aeruginosa, is represented here as being urinary and skin infections. One of the main effects of aeruginosa, which is omitted here, is actually in lung infections. People that are immunocompromised in hospitals, in particular, people that have cystic fibrosis. So this is sort of a short list of what the full list would be. Now, evidently, this is something that's principal goal of the antibiotic resistance group, and that is understanding how resistance has developed over the past century or so, and what are the factors, the evolutionary factors, that might explain selection for resistance alleles and how they can be managed. What I've done here is just simply draw lines between the origin of different antibiotics and the first observation of resistance in a pathogen. Now, this is not perfectly representative, because even though we do find incredible variants in terms of these lifetimes, these are with respect to particular pathogens which might not have been the actual focal pathogen that the antibiotic was originally focused on. So this is, in a sense, a conservative estimate of the different kinds of time lengths that the antibiotics can last. The actual lifetimes are probably much shorter for intense selection on given pathogens. Now, CDC also produces a list like this, what they call the urgent, serious, and concerning threats. The only thing I want you to take home from this is that you see the word resistant virtually everywhere, except for the first pathogen, Clostridium difficile, which turns out not to be necessarily antibiotic resistant, but actually exploits individuals in hospitals that are succumbing to pathogens that are antibiotic resistant. So it's actually associated indirectly with antibiotic resistance. Now, when we tally this all up, and for some reason part of the animation is missing, when we look at the actual impact, this is in the United States only, of antibiotic resistance, we find that roughly 23,000 people every year die due to pathogens and their antibiotic resistant status. So clearly, there it is, there's a very big problem to deal with, not only in terms of future of antibiotic discovery and being able to manage future pathogens. It seems to be okay now. I think it was just the plug was jiggling. Okay. But also how, once we detect antibiotic resistance, can we manage it? Now, there's no magic bullet. This is an interesting graph that shows the different interactions and interrelationships between different compartments. For example, in husbandry, agriculture, and in households, human habitations, and how there might be different interlockings and different interweavings of how pathogens might be transmitted and interacting in different environments, and how the possibility of only focusing on one or two of these is unlikely to be enough to deal with the global management problem. On top of that, as we know with bacteria, they can transfer genes horizontally in three main different ways, through transduction, conjugation, and transformation. This means that antibiotic resistance factors, alleles, are likely to spread from strain to strain and even between different bacteria. So this is the outline of what I'd like to talk to you about today. So by way of introduction, going from the general problem of antibiotic resistance to how we can understand it, and then how can we find alternatives in terms of different kinds of therapies to combat it. So I'd like to first talk about a phenomenon that's really, ironically, with the actual name of this evolutionary rescue taking off over the past year or so. A number of special articles, review articles, and perspective articles on this phenomenon being a general phenomenon to understanding adaptation in stressful environments. Second, I'll talk about some work in our own lab on phage bacteria coevolution and how we can understand, network structure. And finally, I think an important area of future research, evolutionary phage training. That is, we're actually able to use evolution to engineer phage, not in the sense that we're changing the genomes through insertions and deletions, but rather through selection experiments, and can actually move phage in the directions that we want to better combat pathogens, and how we can combine phage together with antibiotics to even do better. And I'll show you some results that suggest that this is, in fact, the case. So the problem is, what we tend to focus on, what doctors tend to focus on, and society wants, is that we want to drive populations of pathogens extinct. We want extinction. We don't want to live with infections. We don't want to live in 2 weeks' time with cancer. That will be one of the topics of the cancer research group. We want to get rid of what is afflicting us. And this is actually turns out more increasing study shows that this is the wrong thing to do for a couple of reasons. So we know that extinction from population dynamic theory will occur if R, that is population growth rate, is less than zero on average for a sufficient period of time. Over time, a population will go extinct if that's the case. What we do in cases where we try to control and, in fact, eradicate a pathogen is achieve rapid extinction. That is, we want R to be much less than zero and it be continuous. Okay? That way, we're able to drive the population to extinction. Now, Andrew Reed's group in particular has argued against this kind of perspective in how to control infectious disease. In the case of his lab, he's looking at malaria. That this kind of recipe is a recipe for disaster because it selects invariably in a large population for resistance. Now, there are different routes to actually understanding why this occurs. And the coining of the term evolutionary rescue is a more generic way of looking at the evolution of resistance. That is, the idea here is that if we're trying to drive a population to extinction and there's no evolution and no pre-existing resistance mutations, then we will actually achieve, of course, the extinction. But routes to evolutionary rescue, that is, the evolution of resistance, can take several different forms. Three of the main ones are here. Either we have pre-existing and or emergent genetic variation, enough of that such that some of the variants will have the resistance factors. Or we have mutagenesis, replication errors, horizontal gene transfer during the control process or the eradication process that's able to save the population from extinction. Or finally, the third main area is what we call the Baldwin effect. That is, there might be, for example, in the case of bacteria, persister cells that are present. They're able to resist, for non-genetic reasons, the stress or the mortality factor due to plasticity. This is then followed by population expansion. And then if there are mutations that can confer the same resistance factor at a smaller cost than the plasticity, we expect those eventually to take over and invade the population. So this is what evolutionary rescue looks like. And this is from a paper published actually just about a month ago by Alan Orr's group, where we look at time, the initial decrease in the population, and we divide the population into two factors. This is the overall net population. Here's the population of resistant cells. And here's the population of sensitive ones. So initially, the population is dominated by sensitive ones, which then go towards extinction, actually go extinct. And at some point, the resistant cells, having been positively selected, now explain the majority of the population size and the overall population rebounds and produces this characteristic U-shaped curve. That's important. Now, we've looked at this in our own lab a couple years ago now, work of a student of mine, Johan Ramsayer, on Pseudomonas fluorescens, a rhizospheric bacteria. And we confronted fluorescens with different doses of the antibiotic streptomycin. And we looked at different factors that would predict success or failure in terms of eradication. Failure corresponding to, of course, evolutionary rescue. And this gives you an example of the different kinds of curves. So in the cases where the populations go extinct, those are the dash curves. We see that the extinctions occur over a time horizon of roughly 50 hours. In the cases of rescue, other populations, other replicate populations, they start becoming rescued after about 24 hours, roughly one day. And what we see here is that roughly, I wouldn't say half-half, but there are representatives in these replicate populations of both outcomes, either extinction or rescue. Now, one of the main results that we have from this, if you compare left to the right, is we looked at clonal populations. That is, populations are initially non-diverse from diversified populations. And we obtain these diversified populations by propagating them for a couple weeks' time in our little microcosms represented here. And what this is able to, what this basically does is creates a more diverse ecosystem, a more diverse population than is the case in the clonal treatments. And what we found is, looking at this data in a different way, is that when we look at the proportion of surviving populations, we find the diversified, the more genetically diverse ones, survive more than the ones that are more clonal, as expected. What we also find is diversified rescue populations decline less rapidly than those that eventually go extinct. So here's population density on a log scale. Here's the clonal population. So there's no difference here in terms of population decline of those that eventually go extinct from those that don't. Whereas when the population is diversified, if the population will go extinct in the future, it will exhibit early on lower densities by chance, as far as we know, because the resistance mutations have not been obtained, presumably, than those which eventually are rescued. So these resistance mutations are basically taking effect, as it were, early on in this population decline process.
Do you mean de novo mutations or standing?
So the evidence that we have is that they're standing. So we did separate experiments that showed standing mutations. So the question is, in these different microcosms, if we have some kind of Poisson distribution of 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, a small number per replicate microcosm, then that could explain the results. If we have hundreds of these, then it's unlikely that any of those vials would have 0. So the average is 100. So our hypothesis is that the ones that went extinct are either stochastically, even having the resistant cells present, that they were not able to multiply and take over. They had some level of sensitivity to the treatment.
Can you comment a little bit more on the diversification?
So they were started by taking a series of, I believe, 10 different clones from parallel microcosms that were transferred and evolved separately.
Okay.
And we then take clones and make a master population from those, as opposed to replicates in the clonal, where it's just a single clone that goes into the...
There's no limitation, so it would still be only a handful of clones continuing.
Yeah.
So it's not millions of different... But this is like...
True. Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. So that could also possibly explain the other question, which is in the case of the actual extinctions, why you can get, let's say, 50-50 go extinct. So is it because we can predict a small number of mutations that are resistant or not? And whether or not this diversified population. So a point taken, but this is what we found. So these would have different genetic backgrounds, and then the question is there some kind of resistant mutation that exists in the initial ancestors?
Yeah, I think, Martin, you suppose we could make sort of a generalization that any time you've got a species or a population that is kind of not far from the central part of its realized niche, but still in its realized niche,
yes,
or a fundamental niche, that it can always come crawling back. And then kind of like Bob Holt or Grimalkowicz or whatnot, once you've actually kicked it out of its fundamental niche, mm-hmm, that at that point it's a very stochastic process of either de novo mutations, accidents, other things that actually allow the species to kind of get itself back into a fundamental niche before its population goes to zero. So you have that kind of evolutionary trajectory trying to push you back in, and then that ecological trajectory with your sort of moment of destiny with extinction. So I would expect that to be much more haphazard.
So you mean in order to explain the variability from replicate to replicate?
Right, yeah.
Okay, yes. So it's unknown. We don't know with certainty how many resistant mutations were present in each of these microcosms at the beginning. We could have tried to control for that, actually introducing known numbers of or concentrations of resistant material, but we didn't. Now, we looked at this in a different way. The second prediction, which is related to the first, is that larger populations are more likely to be saved, rescued, than those that are smaller. We compared two different levels. Now, here we're confounding to some extent volume and population size. So we did this through volumes of a given density of cells, either 1.5 milliliters of microcosm or 0.2 milliliters of microcosm. Prediction being, these larger microcosms, we should observe more rescues. And indeed, that's what we observe significantly. Now, when we look at the initial decline, once again, like in the previous slide of diversified population, the initial decline predicts extinction. That is, if these populations show a very steep slope, those are the ones that are more likely to go extinct. Second interesting result is populations surviving at low doses suffer the larger maximal declines. And this is shown here. Here are the rescued populations, streptomycin dose. Here are the doses, range 30, 40, 50, where we go from having a strong inhibitory effect to having a complete killing effect on the cells within 20, sensitive cells within 24 hours. What we find is that the limit, if you go below 30, then the cells would be down here from pilot experiments. What we found in the actual published experiment is that at a level of 30, that is what would be lethal, but where the cells are more stressed and don't die as fast as the ones in these other treatments, that the actual population decline is larger after 70 hours. Okay, so the rescue also occurs, but it takes a longer period of time at these lower doses. So that could be one possible explanation, is that the costs of the resistant mutations compared to the actual selection pressure, that is lower doses, is such that it's actually just taking longer for these resistant mutations to invade and take over the population. So this is represented in a different way in this slide of the four different strep treatments, 30, 40, 50, and 100. And what I'd like you to focus on, they all look virtually the same except for this. Strep 30, if we look at the frequency of the resistance after 48 hours, otherwise the curves are the same. If you look at the white ones and black ones, is that at 48 hours, the frequency of resistance on average is lower and the population sizes are lower, suggesting that even though these populations are saved, it takes longer for these trajectories to be obtained. okay, which is counterintuitive. You would think that the stronger selection might result in populations that actually take longer to obtain the rescue. Now, perhaps the biggest danger, and this is something that's come up in discussions in a few talks over the past couple weeks, perhaps greater danger than resistance itself are compensatory mutations. That is, we can actually do something about resistance as long as it's not been compensated. So this is illustrated here. What I've done is to represent the relative fitness of resistant variants compared to non-resistant ones. So above 1, resistance is favored. Below 1, it's not favored compared to the sensitive ones. So we have a population here and a mutation selection balance because of the costs due to resistance. The therapy comes on. They're now selected. So their relative fitness goes above 1. Okay? And they'll start increasing in frequency in the population. The therapy will then go off at some future time. So we take 5 days of antibiotic treatment. Therapy goes off. Relative fitness then goes back down. Okay, but because of competitive release, these are now dominant, and these populations are now expanding. And because they're expanding, they can compensate this fitness loss and actually get up to the relative fitness of the resistant variants. Okay, so they're no longer being competitively suppressed by the sensitive variants. They now have the whole niche, so to speak, themselves. They're expanding, and they can get back up here. And once they're up here, there's nothing we can do about resistance in that population, nothing direct in terms of management. Worse yet, let's say that we take 10 days of therapy, 10 days of antibiotics instead of 5. Could be the case that the competitive release now is occurring a bit earlier, okay? Because basically we've now totally gotten rid of all the sensitive cells through the longer period of therapy. The relative fitness will start to increase, and once we release the therapy, it will go slowly back down, or maybe quickly back down, to the relative fitness of 1, and we have absolutely no chance of dealing with the compensatory mutations. They've now come and fixed in the population. So what this means is that aggressive therapies of long duration select for both resistant variants and the rapid evolution of compensatory mutations. So it's kind of like a double whammy in terms of therapy. Being aggressive and long means selection for resistance and almost assured enabling of these compensatory mutations to invade and to fix.
Before you go on, do you know if much has been done to figure out what those compensatory mutations are, given that we generally...
So I do have a slide of which I took out.
Oh, okay.
But I can show some work by Lenski's group showing E. coli and directed mutagenesis, where they're actually creating deleterious mutations. And seeing, I can go to it. And either of, small effect or large effect, let's see.
Maybe if you just remember what genes do they happen to occur in.
Okay. Oh, I think very little is known about that.
Okay.
And how does compensation occur?
Yeah.
Right, so here's Lenski's study. They take large effects versus small effects. This is after the mutagenic treatment that creates either a large deleterious effect or a small one. And here's roughly 200 bacterial generations after and how fitness can be compensated. And there are other studies of this kind. I'm not aware of knowledge of general mechanisms for this, but it's as critical as understanding resistance, I think. The the expectation is that there should always be a cost. Okay, there are two ways to look. We would expect a cost. Let's say that resistance is at a very low frequency in a population. So it's either a mutation selection balance, where there's a cost and these things keep popping up and going extinct. They're basically being outcompeted, or there's some kind of drift occurring. There's no cost, and they're just at low frequency by chance and going extinct and kind of cropping up. There are some good, decent review papers on this problem, in general looking at resistance in to parasitic infections, and the jury is pretty much out. It depends on how costs are measured, whether or not the costs are actually measured in a genetic background where no compensation has occurred. So if you were to measure resistance, so we do antibiotic treatment after 10 days, and then look at the resistant cells, we might find no cost. If we were to do it after 10 hours, we might find one. So the good experiments, I would say, are generally lacking. And the only experiments to get at that would be the ones that actually look at compensatory mutations.
So I'm looking at, what I don't understand is why the compensation would happen while treatment is off. I can see when you take treatment off, that then you start desperately.
Well, it is occurring. So imagine, a population is up here. It's knocked back down like this from the treatment. What is left are resistant mutations. There's nothing keeping them from now growing and repopulating the habitat. And it's during this repopulation that we expect both driver mutations and, which are essentially the same thing, and compensatory mutations. Sure. Okay. Okay, that's a good point. Okay, yes. Agreed. So that the point you're making is that there's a specificity in the compensatory mutations to the drug. And when you take the drug away, they're no longer compensatory. So they could compensate during the drug, but they no longer compensate once you release the drug.
Is it because there's a larger, the population size of resistant types is larger because it's increasing under drug pressure? So you treat and then the resistant ones grow.
Important
then you have a neutral mutation process.
Right, so the important thing is that when you have competitive release, you have this, basically this virgin forest that's being invaded by this replicating population. And if it's going from a couple cells to a billion, which is what we're looking at in our populations, and look at the number of cell divisions required for that and the probability of mutations, there'll be tens of thousands of mutants, of selected mutants that potentially emerge in those populations. So the question is, are they nearly neutral, or is it something that will have a sufficient selective advantage to fix and be a compensatory?
I'm not sure if you're saying it this way, but I think I'm agreeing with what's said. If you remove the drug, but you've got mostly resistant bacteria there, and those are the backgrounds on which mutations are happening spontaneously, so it's a numbers game of something just occurs on those backgrounds that increases their fitness,
exactly,
regardless of whether the drug is... Yeah, I think it's a problem of actually terminology.
So when these subsequent mutations take place, when the trap is being applied, they are just beneficial mutations.
Right.
They're not like compensating the problem.
It's more about like conditionally, something beneficial, neutral, or deleterious. I mean, you just use the word compensatory.
Well, I guess
sometimes
I would see the compensatory as these, I envision them as being co-adaptations. So imagine you set up a detoxification as part of your, but that detoxification chemical may in fact poison some of the other organelles or other structures within it. Now, it's a great thing to have. And then eventually you get mutations that mitigate the downside effects. So these mutations themselves are not beneficial outside of the context of the resistance mechanism. Or you figure out a cheaper way to make it, or a more efficient way. And so I would, in this case, seems like the compensatory would be the sequence of co-adaptations that cause the expense to be less than it otherwise would be. And then those would be in the context of, in the face of the threat. And they would no longer really be beneficial per se in the absence of the threat.
Okay, so the question is it a co-adaptation or something totally independent of the resistance allele? Okay. So there are several alternatives to antibiotics, and looking at more reasoned management strategies, we might actually benefit from either the use of these or combinations of one or more of these with or without antibiotics. So alternatives include antimicrobial peptides. These are proteinaceous toxins produced by many taxa, for example, produced in your epidermis, on your epidermis and in the dermis, which are basically fighting as an innate response, innate immunity to surface pathogens that would otherwise invade your body. Bacteriocins, which are like bees, except they're produced by bacteria to inhibit the growth of related and usually closely related bacteria. And finally, what I'll be talking about today, bacteriophage, which are viruses that are specific bacteria, even certain strains of bacteria. So Darwin comes in here. Basically, what the rest of the talk will is to deal with the following insight, is that bacteria evolved, for example, the case of evolution and rescue to streptomycin or to other antibiotics, when faced with this stressor, okay? It's one evolving population against an abiotic stressor. Whereas when we're dealing with some of these other tactics, and in particular, the use of phage, the bacteria can co-evolve with that mortality agent. So when we look at phage, we see that the basic structure of phages vary considerably. Within families and between families, they're extremely understudied. And even more so, infinitely understudied when we look at their sheer number. This is the estimate. Some of you may have seen this. The estimate number of phage on our planet, most of them being in water bodies, in particular in the ocean. So it's difficult to understand what this number means. For example, to our physics friends, the number of stars in the known universe is about 10 to the 24th, so it's a billionfold or more less the number of phage on our planet. If we take our phage, which you cannot see with the naked eye, they're roughly 1 micron in size, and you put them end to end, this is what you get. So there are a lot of them, they're everywhere, they're the most abundant life form by far on our planet. Now, the phage life cycle, the basic life cycle is as follows. The phage attach to the outer membrane of their bacterial host. They have an affinity through with or without tail fibers to specific proteins on bacterial outer membrane. They then inject, in the case of the phage that we look at in our lab, their DNA into the bacterial cell. They then disrupt the inner workings, in particular the chromosomes, the genetic material of the bacteria, and they turn the bacteria then into what amounts to a phage factory. And these phages, if we were to take a snapshot during this process, you would find what appears to be an assembly line. Different phage fragments, different parts of the phage, which are formed in the bacterial cell and then are assembled together. There'll be phages that are complete, phages that are incomplete, at which time Some of the phage will induce the production of what are called lysins, which will disrupt the bacterial outer membrane, making it permeable, and basically making the bacteria explode and releasing these phage. This holds for the type of phages that we're interested in, that is lytic phages. And here's a picture of an unfortunate bacterium that's infected by some of these phages. Now, what's interesting here, from the standpoint of evolution biology, is that these populations in very, very small scales can be enormous. So because of the enormous populations of bacteria and phage, for example, in a typical 1 milliliter of seawater, one finds roughly on the order of 10 to the 6th bacteria and 10 to the 7th phage. That varies from place to place, but that gives you just a basic idea of how numerous these things are. There's an incredible potential for diversity and for rapid evolutionary responses to selection. And this diversity means interesting insights into communities of interacting strains. So what we want to know in understanding how these phages and bacteria interact and go towards a goal of somehow improving our treatments of pathogenic bacterial infections is to understand who affects whom and who resists whom. And this can be understood by describing and understanding the inner workings of phage bacterial networks. Here are four different classifications of what these networks might look like, and different samples of a paper we published recently with Joshua Weitz finds that all four of these types can be found, but they tend to be dominated by cases where we have modular or nested phage networks. So the question is, what is the diversity of these different kinds of interrelationships in nature, and how did they get to be the way they are? So here are some examples that we published in the paper. Here are two cases of taking a network from the original publication, not realizing that when you look in more detail and analyze it properly, that you can find a nested network of phages and bacteria. Here's the second one. And two cases where it turns out the networks are modular. That is, they're enclaves of phage and bacteria that tend to interact with one another. How did they get to be that way? One explanation for some of these patterns could be co-evolutionary interactions between the bacteria and the phage. And one approach to actually saying, can we construct a network de novo, is the use of experimental evolution, and in particular, experimental co-evolution between bacteria and phage. Now, the interest of using experimental evolution is the following. One is that we're dealing with incredible evolutionary potential due to the large populations. And even with rare mutations, when we have 10 to the 10th, 10 to the 11th cells in a microcosm, it's very, very likely, given known base pair mutation rates, that will create large populations of mutants in these populations. They're also very practical. So the small sizes, short generation times, high level of control, and the fact that we can freeze down these populations that look at them and experiment with them retrospectively makes them incredible laboratory organisms for investigating this kind of problem. What we've looked at in particular in our lab, going back a few years now, is the interactions between Pseudomonas fluorescens, SBW25, and its lytic phage, Phi2, which is shown here. These are plaques of Phi2 growing on a bacterial lawn of fluorescens, SBW25. This is, in many ways, the Drosophila melanogaster of bacteria phage interactions. Most papers on coevolution deal with SBW25. The way we're able to tell who interacts with who is that we take a sample of phage, either from a clone or from a population. We then run it down an agar petri dish, and we then streak, what we call streak, different colonies, different isolates of the bacteria across it. So this is what happens when we streak a bacteria with no phage. We have the colonies that grow very nicely. This would be 20 different clones from a population. When we do the same thing with lines of the phage, we see that they're interrupted. And this indicates virulence of the phage against that isolate or that clone of the bacterium. And what we did a couple years ago now is to create two different treatments in an experiment, each of them having six independent phage ancestors of Phi2, and either co-evolve the phages with supermethyl fluorescence, or evolve them. In the case of evolution, what we're doing is that at each serial transfer, we kill the bacteria, keep the phage, and then reintroduce the ancestor again and again. So only the phage are evolving. Here, only, sorry, the bacteria and the phage are co-evolving. And what we find is the following. We find a very highly significant effect of co-evolution on the nestedness of the network. So here are our phage isolates. I believe that should be from 1 to 20. And here are the bacterial isolates. And we can confront them all one-on-one. And see, we saw who infected whom, who resisted whom. And the level of gray, so either gray or dark, are the number of replicates that were shown to be infected. So in the case of black, it's 100% infection. In the case of gray, it's 2 out of 3 of the replicates that one were infected. When we look at the evolutionary treatment and we confront those evolved phage with the co-evolved bacteria, we find that infection is very low. So these evolved phage have basically specialized on the ancestor, and they're ill-equipped for dealing with these co-evolved bacteria. So they infect them much less. And the nestedness score, there's probably just simply not enough data here, that there's no significant level of nestedness. Now, when we look at, compare the actual growth rate of these different treatments and the infectivity range, that is the range of co-evolved isolates that the phage isolate can infect, we find the following. When we look at the ancestor, we find that it's significantly less in terms of the infectivity range than the co-evolved and the evolved treatments. We find, however, that the evolved treatments have a much higher, significantly higher level of doublings per unit time. So basically what we have here is that the co-evolved are increasing their infectivity range, having very little change in their growth rate compared to the ancestor, whereas the evolved have a slight increase in infectivity range. And the main significant effect is that they're able to double at a faster rate. So basically able to specialize. Looking at this a different way, when we look at host range, the number of isolates that can be infected by a given phage type, we find, as confirmed from the last slide, co-evolutionary treatment can infect, in some cases, up to 9 or 10 of the 20 ones that they encountered. Whereas when we look at the evolution treatment, the host range is much restricted. The specialization on the ancestor has restricted their ability to show a diverse reaction, diverse adaptation to the different kinds of co-evolved bacterial isolates that emerge from the co-evolution treatment. So it appears to be this trade-off between doubling time or growth rate and the host range achievable by these bacteria. Looked at a different way, we look at the ancestral bacteria and susceptible co-evolved bacteria, and we compare what the impact is on the bacterial population. So what we find here is that when we looked at the susceptible co-evolved bacteria, those isolates that are potentially susceptible to phage predation, that the co-evolved ones do better than the evolved ones. Whereas because the evolved ones have effectively been evolved and specialized on the ancestral bacteria, they're now more adapted to infecting the ancestral ones than the co-evolved ones. So the co-evolved ones, despite the fact being encountering diverse bacterial types, have lost their ability to some extent actually infect ancestor. And this will actually become important when we look at phage therapy. So the final result from this study, when we look at the concatenate these different results, is we find a significant but shallow negative relationship between host range, as the number of isolates infected, and the impact on the population. So this is really the summary slide of what we hypothesize as being the main trade-off occurring. Either you're good at exploiting a restricted number of genotypes, or you become more of a generalist and exploit with less efficacy a wider range of genotypes. So in summary, phage bacteria phenotypes interact in structured, often nested networks. Coevolution is suggested by our study produced this pattern. Coevolution increases diversity and host range in phage, whereas evolution increases its impact on the bacterial ancestor. So the second part of the presentation will deal with phage therapy, and here we are working with another pseudomonad, Pseudomonas aeruginosa, which I presented at the beginning of my talk. This is a nice photo of a colony of aeruginosa PA01. Aeruginosa, as I mentioned at the beginning of the talk, is an important pathogen, in particular important nosocomial pathogen, showing high frequencies of representation in pathogenic infections, in diverse sicknesses such as pneumonia, urinary tract infections, bloodstream infections, and so forth. So it's an important pathogen that we want to try to find ways, alternatives to antibiotics in order to control. Now, one of the problems in dealing with aeruginosa in particular is that as of roughly 2004-2005, it's been declared as a pan-resistant pathogen, which means that basically this is resistant to a very wide range of drugs. Sometimes it's partial resistance, sometimes complete resistance. It depends on the actual isolate or strain of aeruginosa that you're dealing with. But what this graph shows is the representation that basically we're going in the wrong direction than where we want to go, and we're finding a steady increase in this resistance to, I believe here it's three or more drugs through time. So the phages can be an alternative therapy. And here I'm going from some of the more fundamental results that I just presented to more how we can use those insights to apply them and somehow do something with these phages beyond simply introducing them on bacteria that will have added value and where we can actually use science towards a more rational application. Different ways we can envision evolution being of importance. It might be that through the variation or changes in the way we time the dose, the actual dose level used, population segment treated, do we treat everyone, only certain people with the antibiotic or the phage? This will make a difference in terms of the evolution of resistance. Should we combine, if we're using phage, should we combine more than one phage? Basically hitting the target from different angles, should we do that? Can we train phage? Training phage involves rapidly, and I'll be talking about this in a few minutes, rapidly evolving the phage into the future and then reintroducing it back onto the person who is afflicted with bacterial infection, or use multi-agent techniques. That is, approaches where we combine perhaps many phage types, but also different antibiotics, to not only hit from different angles, but really with qualitatively different forms of mortality factors. Now, phage training, what does this involve? What it involves is that we're able to do the following. Imagine the following scenario. I go into the hospital for surgery. The incision I have becomes infected with a given pathogen. Turns out that the infection is resistant to antibiotics. One way of possibly dealing with this is to take samples from that infection, bring it to the lab, take a bank of phage that are already in the laboratory associated with the hospital, and start to evolve them under better or even what we could call optimal conditions. And in so doing, what we're able to do is projecting the phage populations into the future by selectively adapting them on the bacteria in the wound. We then, let's say after 24 hours and perhaps 10 generations of phage, which would occur typically over that lapse of time, generate populations of billions of phage from just a small number of phage inoculated, which will have a number of different variants. The ones that tend to dominate the population will be the ones a priori that are most adapted. We then kill those bacteria, which can be done, for example, with chloroform, take the phage, spin them down, concentrate them, and put them back onto the wound. The phage now, a priori, have an evolutionary advantage compared to the ancestor for those bacteria. So this is one way that phage can be trained. So the interesting thing here is that we can actually direct this evolution by changing different selective regimes. Do we want phages that have wider bacterial ranges? Do we want phages that are more specialized, like in the experiment I just showed you, that were able to clobber certain clones within the original infection? Now, the advantage of using phage here is that we can select phages that are highly specific. So we don't have the worry of phages making species jumps from the wound into the body, or let's say if it was a respiratory tract infection, of getting into, let's say, the digestive tract and then killing bacteria in our microbiome. So to some extent, we can control this level of specificity in these phages and keep them safe. Finally, the phages can be kept, collected, and stored virtually indefinitely because they're non-metabolizing, non-respiring, and create what we call phage banks. So we can have stores of these different phage types that take up very, very little space in hospital laboratories. Now here's a picture of Aeruginosa PA01, the beast that we use in our lab. And what we see here is what we did is we spotted a diluted population of a bacteriophage, and that's what these orange dots are. So we can dilute them to the point where you can identify individual phage colonies on this mega bacterial colony. And they basically punch holes in it. So here's an experiment we conducted a couple years ago where we tried a basic approach to training phage. And what this involved was to do 6 serial transfers. And each transfer, what we did is we took the phage and bacteria, killed bacteria, purified the phage, and then transferred it again onto the ancestor. So what we would predict from this Poulin et al. Study that I just showed you on networks is that what we're doing is specializing the phage on a limited range of bacterial ancestral phenotypes. And this summarizes what our results are. We tried 4 different phage. It turns out that we had no expectations of what these 4 phages would do. 2 of the 4, PEV2 and LUZ7, showed virtually 100% infection, both at the beginning and after they were trained. Training did nothing better. If you're going from 99% infection to 99.5, you're getting very little out of it. In contrast, 2 of the other phages that we used, LKD16 and 14.1, showed significant effects of training. Here we have the T0 level when encountering the ancestral bacterial type, and what we find is we get up to roughly 100% infection. The same thing for 14.1. More exciting is that when we have bacteria from the original infection, in this case it's in vitro, but imagine in the original infection that have evolved resistance, and that's shown by these increased levels of resistance in these 2 treatments, training the phage, in this case over 6 transfers, is able to bring the infectivity levels up. So our trained phage not only are able to hit and improve the ancestor, but should some degree of evolution occur, resistance occur, the phage are also good at combating that level of resistance. Unfortunately, we didn't go beyond this and look at bacteria from T2, T3, T4, T5, and so forth. So what about co-evolutionary training? This was evolutionary training. What about co-evolutionary training? Now, in order to understand co-evolution, we need to understand something about the dynamics, because the fact of projecting phage through evolution into the future is not necessarily a good thing. It depends on the type of evolution that occurs. If we're dealing with something that's like a co-evolutionary arms race, where the speed of flight of this moth is selected to increase should the speed of flight of this bat increase, and basically escalating our abilities and given trait to escape or to predate, that is something very different from the other main type of co-evolution that's been observed. That's sometimes called red queen dynamics or fluctuating dynamics. Here, we have different variants that are fluctuating through time, and no single variant that can dominate all possible other variants. There's no net escalation through time. It's more fluctuations. So this is representing the following graph from a paper several years ago by Simon Gondon's group, where when we look at models and predict what happens in escalation, and we do what we call time shift experiments, that is, we take, in this case, parasites from the future and confront them with hosts from the past, we expect more virulence. And when we take ones from the past and confront them with bacteria from the future, we expect less virulence. So we have this typical time shift curve, which would be indicative of an arms race. Compare that with fluctuating selection, which is shown here and actually in these two graphs. So these two go together. Here are the different replicates. Here is a mean representation. Here is fluctuating selection. There's no overall trend in the past, contemporary, and future time shifts. And we look through the average of time, it'll show some kind of fluctuation. So if we take one's parasites here and confront them with bacteria from here, it's possibly be more virulent, but if we go back a bit further in time, they're no longer more virulent. We don't get net escalation. Now, we tested this using a panel of six phages together with the same student, Alex Betts, and we considered two different families of phage, the Miroviridae and the Podoviridae, and multiple representatives of each of these two. What we found is the following. In only 1 in 6 cases did we find a statistical significant signature of arms race dynamics, despite the fact that two of the other phages show trends in that direction. For the other three phage, statistically, these are more consistent with fluctuating selection dynamics. So on the same bacterial background, depending upon the phage we use, we find a range of co-evolution dynamics that can emerge. Meaning that in the more applied realm, using fluctuating type of phage might have some advantages in terms of training, or maybe not compared to the arms race type. And we looked at that in the following graph. What we've done here is take bacteria from transfer 4, 5, and 6, and then confront them with phage that are either 0, 1, or 2 steps in the future. So this would be co-evolutionary training only 1 or 2 steps into the future. What we find, as expected, in all cases, the resistance of these bacteria decreases through time. So the training is working. But the actual effects, in terms of magnitude, would be very different from one another. We find that in terms of training, LMA2 and 14.1, which tend to show arms race dynamics, training does actually very little to improve phage efficacy. Whereas when we train LUZ7, which is actually the strongest signal of a fluctuating selection system, we find that going 2 steps to the future has an enormous impact on the bacterial population. In the case of LUZ19, this is highly virulent from the outset, and basically the bacteria are almost not able to evolve any resistance at all. So training this kind of phage would make little sense. You'd want to probably use the ancestor of this. Training these phages would probably make very little sense because they never attain real virulence, and our likely candidate for training would probably be the LUZ7. So through understanding covalent interactions, we're able to get a greater understanding in terms of how they could be applied in phage therapy. So the end of my talk, which applies to the title of the talk, is on how we can actually combine phages and antibiotics to control Pseudomonas aeruginosa infections. Why is this important? Now, going back to a number of slides I've shown about the dire situation we have with antibiotics and the fact that in either months or a small number of years, we're selecting for resistance and many times multi-drug resistance to these antibiotics, we're also confronted with a situation that we have fewer and fewer new variants through time. We're running out of antibiotic alternatives. So this means that even more so, the use of alternatives such as phage become increasingly important. And perhaps there's a way of using some of these antibiotics that have some level of resistance, but to what, where the resistance expressed by the bacteria is not too high, using those in combinations with phage might be the most sensible solution to fighting certain types of infections. Now, we looked at this in a preliminary study using Pseudomonas fluorescens, and this was published a couple years ago, but the actual work goes back to 2008-2009, where we went back to the fluorescens Phi-2 system and looked at how Phi-2, with or without rifampicin, could control these populations. So what we have here on this graph is log bacteria after 24 hours, control population. Unfortunately, the quality is not very good, where you can see the different replicates, the means, and the confidence intervals. Control, adding phage has a small impact after 24 hours, roughly half an order of magnitude. Rifampicin, very little, because basically these have been evolutionarily rescued, so resistance from rifampicin has occurred. But when we use sequential phage and then antibiotic treatments, we find a highly significant effect of this combination. When we put them in together, that is, phage and antibiotic goes in together, we have no difference from the controls. So there's something in, apparently, in the time delay between the introduction of the phage at the beginning of the experiment here and the introduction of the antibiotic that's having an effect. Now, we looked at this in more detail in a paper published about 1 year ago. Paper is now accepted and almost in press, where we're looking at Pseudomonas aeruginosa here, and one of those six phages. We're looking at LUZ7, which is an N4-like phage that shows FS, that is fluctuating selection dynamics, so we remember from two or three figures ago, and how we can combine that with streptomycin to try to achieve better outcomes than either of those separately. So we have a phage-only treatment. The antibiotic-only treatment is either simultaneous, 12 hours after or 14 hours after. And the combined treatment is with phage at time zero, antibiotic simultaneously, 12 hours after or 24 hours after. And this is what we found. So what we have plotted here is no antibiotic treatment and antibiotic addition time, either 0 hours, 12, or 24. What we're looking at here then is after 7 hours, what the population size of these bacterial microcosms show. You find a significant effect, though slight, of actual phage only, so using the phage and phage therapy has an effect on the bacteria, but it's not very, very high. Using antibiotic only is very similar, with a slight trend towards more suppression as the delay increases, this being due to the delay in the evolutionary rescue. OK, Okay, so these have had enough time, 24 hours extra, to be rescued, and they've gone back to the control levels. These would probably require another 24 hours to make it back up this level. When we combine phage and antibiotic, we decrease these populations by orders of magnitude. And in particular, there's a specific time frame. We only tried three different timing levels, but what we find is this intermediate level of 12 hours post phage introduction from the antibiotic gives the lowest population density. Now, it turns out that we have some evidence using simple assumption that what would have happened had we had additive mortality of phage plus antibiotic. Well, this is the prediction. The expected level of populations had we just simply combined mortalities. What we find, however, is statistically significant lessening, that is, drops in the three of these different treatments, 0, 12, and 24 hours, when we have these two mortality agents together. That is, there's a synergism in terms of the combination of these two therapies, well beyond the additive effect. Now, what's interesting is not only do we find that the population levels of the bacteria are minimized at 12 hours post-introduction of the phage, but we also find that antibiotic resistance is also minimized. Here we used minimum inhibitory concentration. It's scored on a scale that's given here. What we find is that there is a significant effect of time, in particular, with the lowest level of resistance for this intermediate time. And it turns out that we find the same thing for bacteriophage resistance. Here's where we have antibiotic only, okay? Very low levels of bacteriophage resistance, nevertheless, higher than either the ancestor or control. So we have no explanation for why this is occurring. It might be some kind of interaction of antibiotic resistance with the ability to resist phage, perhaps outer membrane receptors, which are involved in both antibiotic resistance and phage absorption. And when we combine antibiotics plus phage, again, the minimal resistance against the bacteriophage are occurring at this intermediate time point. So the conclusion is that for three different measures of performance, minimizing populations, minimizing antibiotic resistance, and minimizing bacteriophage resistance, they're all occurring at the same point. Now we also find, this is contrary to our expectation, we would assume that all else being equal, resistance to antibiotics would have a cost in terms of the ability to evolve phage resistance, and vice versa. Phage resistance would have some kind of cost that all else being equal would mean less antibiotic resistance. We found the opposite. We found a significant effect, significant positive correlation between resistance in these two traits, suggesting that similar mechanisms are involved in resisting antibiotics and in resisting phage. So in summary, phage training can increase the impact of phages that are initially at low effectiveness against bacteria. Not all phages get better this way. In fact, we only showed that one of the six phages got substantially better in terms of coevolutionary training. These phages can overcome at least the initial evolution of resistance, which was shown in that first study, where the T6 phage were able to effectively control T1, that is the evolved bacteria. Coevolutionary dynamics may predict whether trained or non-trained phages will be more effective in therapy. Phage antibiotic combinations are better than either alone and show a window of highest effect, both in terms of density and resistance at these intermediate times. So here's my last slide. Here's what I think the future will hold. I think there are some exciting times ahead of us in combining fundamental knowledge of these processes and translating these in terms of actual application. We can integrate evolutionary knowledge, through training, through understanding of cross resistance, all of this can be done in the lab. We have the means of doing this. We just have to devise scenarios, alternative scenarios, see what these scenarios predict, why the scenarios do what they do, understanding from evolutionary theory, and then go and try to test these as best we can in situ. Also, in terms of the actual concept of single versus combined therapy, there's now an increased track record for the logic of using many different types of mortality agents or control agents for different kinds of pathogens, in the case of viruses, HIV, and tritherapy. And these are increasingly used, multiple therapies, combination therapies against cancers. And I'll finish there. Thank you.